Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, March the 20th. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Whew, what a couple of weeks, but I went over that with you guys in the last episode. Seriously, thank you so much for tuning in to the podcast today. I want to start off by giving a huge shout out to patrons of the show. You can go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. But thank you to Kim, Barb, Arnie, Helen, Sarah, Kristen, Stan, greatly appreciate your contributions to the show. The last couple of weeks have been a little wild. Actually, last week, I don't want to use the word apology, but for a split second I had planned on giving some kind of an apology because I felt like last week's episode, in full transparency, was literally the concept of it. It had kind of been like spinning around in my brain for a little bit, but overall, it was kind of like, thought about it 20 minutes before I just got a text from Kelsey Graham. Shout out to you, Kelsey. I know that you're listening. So that was the beep that you heard in the background. But I thought I was going to have to come on here and make an apology. The episode was somewhat thrown together. I thought about it maybe 15 minutes before I started rolling. And yet it was very, very well received when I went over Steve Ozanich's, basically his TMS checklist. Amazing feedback from people. So love hearing stuff like that. And as it goes, I was supposed to do that interview with Caitlin Michaels again last week, and I was under the weather when we were supposed to record it. So we are now pushing it. We're going to do it via Skype. We're going to answer all the questions that people had sent in. We're going to do that, I think it's next week, the end of next week. But then I'm going to go back to Schaumburg in May, and hopefully all the ducks will be in a row and the stars will align and we will record that show together in May in person. On the show today, I'm going to do kind of a quick open here because this is an awesome interview with Jessica Shahinian. And what's interesting is Jessica Shahinian was one of the first YouTube videos I found on TMS. She's had a couple of series on TMS, but if you just go to YouTube and you type in TMS in all likelihood, or tension myositis syndrome, in all likelihood, she is going to pop up. And we run through this and I kind of get her story, but I'm going to list off some of the diagnosis that she had gotten over time because it's really pretty amazing. I would say this is probably the most extensive of lists for people that have had symptoms, but basically low back pain, bilateral hip pain, and I'm not listing these off in any kind of order, but multiple herniated discs, TMJ, let's see here, pelvic pain, whiplash, fibromyalgia, tinnitus, piriformis syndrome, spastic colon, IBS, dairy intolerance, intestinal bleeding, acid reflux, Crohn's disease, constipation, tingling and numbness, blurry vision, generalized anxiety, panic attacks, tremors, full body tremors, incontinence, chronic acne, chronic fatigue, post-traumatic stress syndrome, chronic cough. So like the list goes on and on. Let's see here, 25, 36. Yeah, I mean, basically there are 59 conditions or 59 symptoms that Jessica had. So it's really amazing. We're going to run through this story with her, and she's going to talk a lot about a lot of the things that she's doing because she's now the outreach director for the PPD, which is the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association. So she's the outreach director for that. She's out of New York, and it's really a tremendous interview, but you can find her all over the internet. All the links and all these different places that you need to find her will be kept in the show notes, but you can go to ppdassociation.org. And she's done educational videos for Got Pain Cure that have been viewed in over 33 countries by health professionals and the public. So really pretty amazing. I think you guys are going to love this interview. Thank you again so much for tuning in. I'll be back next week, of course, with a new episode. But sink your teeth into this interview with Jessica. It's really pretty amazing hearing her story and her comeback and ultimately her very, very rapid cure. So here's Jessica. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I am here with Jessica Shahinian, who is the Outreach Director for the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association. Jessica, are you there?
I am here.
Great to talk to you. You have one of those familiar voices where I try to think back of I remember exactly where I was when I found Healing Back Pain on Amazon, and I remember it was either when I went to YouTube, which people that are into media like me because I can binge watch YouTube stuff all day. I think that I typed in Dr. Sarno and I found a video from a business guy in Australia talking about it. And then I think I saw yours. And then I think I binge watched everything that you had done as of a year and a half ago. So it's cool to finally have a connection with you.
Yeah, no, for sure. And we also spoke as well because we're both in some of the same TMS Facebook groups. So
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess maybe let's just start with your story's pretty amazing. Let's, for the purpose of this, just pretend like nobody knows about it. We can actually treat this as, it's not the first recovery / quote unquote expert in the field, because, you know, David Hanscom had problems and Dr. David Schechter had problems. And so and Alicia Batson had issues. And so a lot of these people, I think, that are in the medical field, they have experienced mind body syndrome issues, but yours is one of the more amazing stories that I've seen of a true extinction burst, the tsunami hits and then it retreats as if nothing happened. So maybe start with your background. I know that, you know, you've been a dancer and you've been a variety of different things. Tell us about your background, pre any of these problems, and then your symptoms and your diagnosis. And then ultimately, you know, tell us that the riveting moment when it went away, because I feel like that's the really exciting part.
Ooh, yeah. That's a lot of points. So feel free to interject if you need. But it's true. In summary, I've done a lot of things in my life for someone who's only been around 30-ish years. But the majority of my life I spent pursuing dance and performing internationally as a dancer and briefly as an aerialist, which is, if anyone's familiar with Cirque du Soleil, it's performing contortionism in the air up to 50 feet for me. And at the height of my career, literally while being an aerialist, that's when my worst symptoms began. Even though I had PPD, which is the acronym I use, psychophysiologic disorders, even though I had PPD symptoms going back since 13 and possibly sooner, which I only recognized in hindsight, it only became a serious problem to the point where it nearly ended my dance career and nearly ended my life starting in 2013.
So it wasn't even all that long ago that the problems got, to steal a quote from someone who I interviewed a few weeks ago, Michelle Hinsberger, she said that looking back, I sort of had these issues going back a long way, but there got to a point to where I couldn't ignore them anymore. And that sounds like what you're talking about.
Yeah, there was no way in heck I could have possibly ignored it. No one even knew what to do with me. And I'm, as a dancer, and you know, because you're an athlete, you cannot ignore when you're becoming disabled by symptoms.
Yep.
We're used to pushing through pain, and we view pain very differently than non-athletes. Pain is expected. No one will let you complain about it. The show must go on, no matter if you have a sprained ankle or a loved one has recently passed away. You must still perform. But when you physically can't move and your body parts aren't functioning and you're bleeding intestinally and no one knows why, that is a problem.
And I think it's an important distinction too, because when I talk to people outside of the circle, which I feel like we're both in, the understanding is very, very tough. Let me give you an example. I do CrossFit now, and I was at the gym yesterday and I did 50 deadlifts at 275 pounds. And my low back is lit up today. But that's a different type of feeling than chronic pain, right? This should go away in a day or two, and I fully expect it to. And I'm going in and lifting more today. And, it's completely a different feeling than the hell that I went through for that certain amount of time. And as athletes and people that do things that involve physicality, yes, you are certainly used to pushing through something, but when the problem has been around for so long and you can't get it diagnosed or figured out, or it's not making medical sense, or even if it is making medical sense, essentially if it's stuck around for a certain amount of time, that's the time to raise the eyebrows. As difficult as it is to see the forest through the trees when you're deep in it, like you would have been in 2013.
Yeah. And I was definitely deep in it. And I did everything that a good dancer should do. And it just made it worse. And not only did I get shunned from the dance community and everyone I'd ever worked with, because dancers are nothing if they're injured, apparently, so I was told. But I also couldn't even be a pedestrian, and that's what really bothered me. I was grieving for a while when I was told that I would never dance again by 20 health professionals in nearly every different specialty within healthcare. But when they also were passing off the idea that, no, we can't answer why your legs sometimes collapse when you try to walk. No, we can't answer why you're incontinent for a year and a half. And no, we don't know if when you go numb, if that feeling will return. And no, we don't know why you're bleeding intestinally, but good luck with that. It was very scary because I couldn't even have a desk job. I couldn't even do anything. And that was not cool. So that's what led me to being suicidal for a lot of reasons.
Talk about the, one of the more popular, and it's weird because I don't know if I've actually had, maybe I have, interviewed people that have had the diagnosis of the dreaded herniated disc. And I know that you have a lot of them. And so, talk about like seeing the imaging, knowing that it's there, being told what would happen if you didn't get it addressed, what was recommended to get it fixed, kind of jump on the herniated disc wagon for a moment.
Yeah, that was the first part of it. Good for you for bringing it up. Because even though there were so many symptoms, I had about 20 symptoms at once starting in 2013. I was still performing on the cruise ship that I was on. But the reason why I got sent off the ship was because I was diagnosed with a couple herniated discs in my lumbar spine and the low back. And because of that, they said, oh, well, this will need 3 weeks of physical therapy. We can't do it on the ship. You have to go back home, which for me was flying across the Atlantic Ocean to get back home. And 3 weeks of physical therapy turned into 2 years of failed treatments from steroid injections and everything else to being told, we don't know what to do with you. There's nothing to do. Even surgery wouldn't help you. But the herniated disc factor, being told that I had these herniated discs, which, by the way, for me, I mean, of all the things to truly believe that the herniated discs were causing my symptoms, it was even more believable because I had multiple MRIs over the course of 2 years. And each time I had another one, my herniated discs actually got worse. So it was very easy for me to believe when doctors were saying that your herniated disc is causing at least some of your pain. And I was also very depressed at the time that I had herniated discs because I was well aware that you don't actually fix it. You can remove the excess tissue, but you cannot fix it. It doesn't come back once it's fully herniated. So I was actually sad. As a dancer, you don't want any part of your body to be permanently damaged. But the truth is, as I later learned, it's not damage. It's just a natural part of aging, just like graying of the hair.
Yep.
And though I might have accelerated the timeline for how intense my herniated discs became in my low back and my neck, I found out I had at least four herniated discs over the course of 2 years. None of it causes my symptoms because I have far worse herniated discs now than I did in 2013. Like I said, they got worse and I am completely symptom free. But at the time, I had multiple health professionals saying that I was indicated to have surgery, starting with a microdiscectomy with hemilaminotomy, which is the typical herniated disc surgery for my lumbar spine. That was for the L5-S1. And if that had failed, then they would have done a spinal fusion. And then if that had failed, they would have done more spinal fusions of higher and higher vertebrae. But I did get two steroid epidural injections, one of which I had to have without anesthesia because I had to walk myself home after. And you can't have anesthesia if you're going to walk home.
Right.
But unfortunately, the stress of the situation actually caused me to be unable to walk anyway, so that was unfortunate.
I think that like sometimes people, if they get the herniated disc diagnosis. Like they can point to, they would say, oh, well, it happened in a car accident or it happened in this. Was there any particular moment where you, because like with me, when my pain got so bad, I couldn't ignore it. Like first when the sciatica started, the way that I would justify it is like, oh, I've been doing a lot of squats. And so somehow maybe that is the cause of it. But when all the back and the neck spasms started, there was nothing that I did that like should lead it in the way. Like there was just nothing that I could point at other than maybe there might've been something months earlier, but you know, that didn't really make any logical sense to me. Was there anything, cause I just, excuse my ignorance for dance, right? But was there anything that was like an impact injury where it was like, oh yeah, that for sure was what did it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. For both my low back and my neck, slightly, they're only funny stories to me now because it's so ridiculous, the trauma that I went through during this 2-year period. No, by no means were they funny at the time. So low back herniated discs to me relate to the fact that during that cruise ship contract, I was training for a particular aerial act that had what's called a halo harness. Now, a 2-point harness is where you can flip forwards and backwards, but a halo harness allows you to flip in 360 degrees while performing your act. And it has to be excruciatingly tight in order for you to control all your movements just through your pelvis and momentum. But the problem was it was not fitted to someone with my hip size. It was fitted to someone multiple dress sizes smaller than me. And the trainers said, oh, we'll size it to you when the show starts, but due to this show transition, just deal with it. It's like 6 to 8 inches smaller than it should be. So my pelvis actually got crushed. And after that first rehearsal, my body went numb from my like belly button to my mid thighs and everything in between for 18 and a half hours straight. And that's when a lot of pain began and everything really hurt. So it seemed very clear that the low back herniated discs were because of having my pelvis crushed in this aerial harness. And then as for my neck herniated discs, I was actually strangled and thrown by my neck and heard a snap. The only good part of that story is that for the audience listening, other than that, I was okay. I was actually performing in a TV pilot because I was also an actor. And I was performing in a scene where my co-star was supposed to strangle me, but he actually strangled me. He did not understand stage combat. So I was actually strangled and tossed by the neck, and I heard a pop, and then I got checked out and found 2 herniated discs in my cervical spine. So yeah, it seemed very clear that there was an acute injury for both. And then as for the hips, though, I didn't mention the hips yet. I have completely torn cartilage in both hips.
At the labrums?
Yep. Yeah. Both my labrums are like completely gone. And that was basically just told to me, dance. Nothing specific as an injury, just over time.
Yeah. You know, the labrums are interesting because you have them in your hips and you have them in your shoulders. And when I had dislocated my shoulder a few years ago, 2015, and I went from doctor to doctor. This was kind of the start of health anxiety for me, you know, Googling symptoms and doing all that. And I remember a couple of the doctors that I went to had said that my physical symptoms didn't necessarily align with what a torn labrum would suggest. But then they did the imaging and one doctor would say that I tore one thing and another doctor would say I tore another. Ultimately, still, regardless whether it was what one person said or what the other one said, my symptoms did not align with what, because there was just certain nerves that were having problems that didn't align at all with what would have been passing in that area at all. Still went ahead and had surgery, and they did it, and I awakened from the surgery, and you know, magically, like the nerve problems are gone. But then as we get 2 or 3 weeks before I'm about to be medically cleared and have to now do, you know, take on all the responsibilities to which I had before, that's when like sciatica started, right? So you, like this classic like distraction idea really comes into play. So let's fast forward about, you know, when it was like, how was it first suggested to you that maybe, actually, you know what, let's go back a little bit. Was there, you had talked about, I was so depressed at this point in time. I'm sure there was some anxiety. We've talked about the physical stuff, the back and the neck and the hips. Talk about, you know, maybe more of the psychological issues that may have arisen out of this time, because I can see like, you know, being an athlete and seeing my body wilt away and drop 35 pounds over a couple of months, like when, you know, as a weightlifter, you're trying to get a certain look and be able to lift certain amounts of weights. And I just sat there and watched my body wither away. So I certainly had some of that. Tell me about what you maybe had as some of this stuff was going on that was more psychological.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot there, which is hard to summarize, so I'll try. Part of where the psychological part came into is, again, the pain didn't scare me as nearly as much as no reason whatsoever for why my legs would collapse when I would try to stand or walk and be numb for half a day, being completely unable to walk or go anywhere. Also because I live in New York City, trying to cross city streets and then just having your legs collapse and be like, oh God, I'm going to get hit by a car. That's really scary. And I was always alone and I was only commuting to and from doctor's appointments. I would have to crawl into the backs of cabs and crawl out of them, lay down in the back, spending all of my money, which I had none left because I was a dancer. We don't get paid much.
Yeah.
And just going to these appointments. So the numbness was extremely scary. The incontinence was annoying and very frustrating and confusing, but bleeding intestinally for no reason that anyone can point to and being told that it might be colon cancer, considering that my dad passed away from colon cancer when I was 20, which, what do you know it, that's when my colon symptoms started, right when he was terminal. And especially after he passed away, that's when I first started bleeding. That was scary to have to get two colonoscopies at age 26 within 8 months of each other, being told misdiagnosis actually the first time that, yes, we found colon polyps that could become malignant, but they're not right now, but they're called with a germinal center. And I was actually sent off to my cruise ship after the first colonoscopy being told, as long as you do not bleed out and die, you should be able to perform 9 months as a dancer and aerialist internationally. That is actually what a gastroenterologist told me. But another very scary symptoms were what I thought were heart attacks, and I ruled out were not heart attacks. My heart was healthy, though they were the full symptomology of heart attacks, chest pain, arrhythmia, everything else that comes with it, left arm tightening, all that. I had that for a long period of time and had to wear a heart monitor for a month. I was rushed to the ER multiple times because of making sure I wasn't going to die of a heart attack. And then also full body tremors for a year and a half straight, which began after a traumatic incident in the hospital, again, during my treatment for all of this mess of conditions that were all mind-body. I was rushed to the hospital with cauda equina syndrome, and they gave me 2 doses of liquid morphine. Also in that brand was Dilaudid. And if people don't know what that is, it's actually super heroin in its purest form, wow, essentially. And I passed out, woke up convulsing for 4.5 hours straight. And since that moment, I kept having the same symptoms, which I thought had something to do with medicine or some reaction to it. But it was actually, I don't know, mind-body symptoms are terrible like that. I ended up convulsing and having these full body tremors very frequently for a year and a half. So those symptoms that gave me all these near-death experiences of being alone in the hospital, genuinely thinking, oh my God, this is it. Oh my God, this is it. Every single time I actually did. I listened to your interview with Christy, by the way, in which she said, also in a chipper tone like me, because we're both perfectionists and goodists, she also said in a chipper tone how she almost called her mom thinking that this is it.
Yeah.
And I actually did call my mom from a hospital bed thinking this was it on that same day where I woke up convulsing. Yeah, that combined with the fact that I was running out of money seemed like I thought I was going to die anyway, and I wanted to do it in a way that wouldn't bankrupt my mom. It's a really unfortunate situation, but it's very true that I was seriously panicking, and I also had no social life. I was extremely heartbroken that not only the dancers that I had performed with were the way that they reacted to me being injured and sick was absolutely heartbreaking to me and still is. I still have a hard time with that, of how people can treat other people that way. They actually thought it was funny that I thought I was going to have cancer and die.
Yeah.
And they socialized with that with social media, and I actually saw some of it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is awful. I was told I would never dance again, and they thought it was hilarious. So that didn't help. So that's the psychological side, is true fear.
You know,
not just the unknown, but fear that you think that the certain is terrible. Catastrophizing, essentially.
Right. You know, that whole concept makes me think of something, and this may seem related and it may not seem related, but I was thinking the other day I'm reading this book by a guy named Paul David. He's talking about basically like recovery from anxiety. And one of the things that he talks about in there is basically just, you know, being okay essentially with whatever outcome happens. And it makes me think of back when I was like petrified of flying, like, you know, the obviously like the sweaty palms and all this, but I always felt like there's a greater than set, which is absurd, but it's a greater than 75% chance of this plane's going to take a nosedive as soon as we get into the air and I'm going to die. And that's, you know, and that's all I would think about, like as the plane would take off and as it would land. And then I remember there was a flight I took like 9 years ago where I just saw, it's almost like that moment where I open my arms up, I surrender, and I say, okay, like if the plane goes down, like there's nothing I can do about it. I'm okay with it. And I remember like my intense fear of big commercial planes like vanished on that day. And so I think about when you're sitting there in hospital bed, getting ready to call your mom and say like, this is it. That brings a lot of anxiety. If you were to be able at the time to make that call and say, this is it, and be 100% okay with it, like that's a completely different, that's a whole different thing. Right. And part of all of this stuff is so much to do with fear, which is what you just touched on. So what was the turning point? How did you get to the turning point? How did you discover the work of Dr. John Sarno, who, again, this podcast is almost essentially all about? how did you get to that point? Was it a doctor that made a suggestion, or was it just, you know, just by chance you stumbled upon it on the internet? Like, how did you get there?
I wish a doctor had suggested it, and I wish I stumbled upon it on the internet, but I didn't. And that's why I do the work that I do, of educating professionals and the public and making online materials. The way I found out about mind-body symptoms is an acquaintance who at the time I barely knew, someone I did an acting audition for, saw a Facebook post of mine in which I was having another procedure done and being unable to walk and get myself home from the hospital. And I posted, hey, can anyone help pick me up from the hospital? I can't walk. They won't let me leave. And he responded to that in a long and very sweet email saying, hey, listen, I've been seeing these posts that you are clearly dealing with chronic pain and all these health issues. I went through a similar thing. I got better by reading this book, Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. You should check it out. And I, at that time, was so close to actually going through with suicide. I had plans in the works, and it was a very terrible situation. And I, as soon as I read that email, I instantly bought the book on Amazon, started reading it as soon as it arrived, starting at like 8 p.m., lying in bed. And while reading the book, had an epiphany that led me to recovering within a week.
Yeah, that is crazy. And I think that it's so different from a lot of the story, because there's plenty of quote unquote like book cures that are out there, but a lot of them have to do with, and when I say like surface level back pain, I'm not diminishing any, you know, what anybody has to say, because for me it was not an immediate thing, not even remotely close. But you had so many serious symptoms that like very rarely, 99.9% of people would say like you need to go and keep seeing doctors, but like when is enough enough? And so like, what do you think that the, I mean, was it just you had exhausted every other option and really this has to be it, and your body almost just gives up the fight? Like, talk, like, what do you think happened on the inside that caused such a drastic change? And you said it took a week and all the symptoms were gone, but like, when did you initially see, okay, something is changing?
Yeah, something was changing as soon as I was midway through the book, which is why then by a week later, after finishing the book, all of the symptoms I had at that point had at least individually, each and every one of those symptoms had paused. And because they paused, I knew that it was possible to relieve the symptoms, that it was possible these symptoms could be cured, like the book and Sarno described. So then they stayed gone for 8 months before I even had a pop of a symptom again, often referred to as the symptom imperative. But I consistently have been able to get rid of any symptoms that pop up, usually within minutes, sometimes hours, sometimes seconds, depending on the symptom. Though there are two exceptions to that. I can get into that later, of times where I had another longer lasting case for good reason, and I got rid of it nonetheless. So
what was the first symptom imperative that you saw? You said it was 8 months later.
Yeah, 8 months later, it must have been something like a back spasm. Because even during that first week, while I was still getting all my symptoms to go away, any time that all my symptoms would pop up, because they were popping up a lot within that first week after reading the book. I mean, they were existing all the time for 2 years straight prior to that. The epiphany while reading the book was that while I was laying down in my bed, perfectly safe physically, nothing in that moment that could have been physically describing anything that would suddenly happen to me, I was relatively lower pain and no other symptoms at that very moment. But then while reading this book and having my emotions come forward of rage and frustration over everything, all of my symptoms flared up all at once. And that was the epiphany, because I finally in that moment couldn't say that any one of those symptoms were, oh, it's because I bent over. Oh, it's a medical reaction to this medicine. Oh, it's because of this. Oh, it's because of that. Suddenly it was, oh, it's because of my emotions. Yep. Oh, it's because of trauma and stress. And in the same way that all the symptoms came up, they could go away. So it was, I didn't even have time to question it almost. I just fully committed to that, because it was either that or death for me. So I committed to that. And the only reason why I did, I was in such a bad mental state at the time. The only reason why I committed to that was because my mom really didn't want me to commit suicide.
Yeah.
I owed it to her to try. And I was trying so hard, and I already had been trying so hard, but to actually try the right approach with the same passion and vigor that I had already been trying with every other physical therapy and medicine and alternative everything, it worked. But the thing is, it's consistent work. You consistently have to be aware, and you can't ever let yourself give in to thinking, oh, it's because I bent over. Oh, it's because this chair is too hard or too soft. You always have to recognize what's causing the symptoms. Otherwise, they will last. The only way you get them to go away is by doing the same process that works for you. And I feel like I have a whole toolkit now of ways to get rid of not just 20 symptoms, but I have had over 30 or so symptoms. I can get rid of all of them.
So that's interesting. So talk about because one question that I get asked a lot is like, what are one or two things that I can do that maybe I haven't thought of? And I think it's so like individualistic. There's a couple of them that I feel like should be highlighted more than others. But what are maybe a couple of the more common ones? If you start to have a tightening of your back, or if you start to just kind of feel off, like what are a couple of things that you pull out of the toolkit and leverage right away?
It's a good question. I feel like the response is different for someone who already knows what mind-body symptoms are versus someone who doesn't. For someone who doesn't know, I would point out to them that the process of catastrophizing, fearing the worst, is 100% linked to increasing those symptoms. Any symptom caused by stress gets instantly accelerated when you fear that they will never stop and that they will get worse and that everything in your life will just get worse from this point.
Yep.
So reducing fear is the number one way and the, I feel like, the fastest way to recover, even if that requires you finding other ways of making yourself believe that you're safe, not just feel like you're safe, but believe that you're safe on a very unconscious, deeper level, which requires self-care, different forms of it. And that's where the toolkit comes in. Everyone has different ways of making themselves feel calm and centered and safe. But it also, for a longer term benefit, instead of doing distraction things like binge watching Netflix, like I've done way too many times, it'd be better to actually lean into the tension that's there when you feel a symptom and recognize what is bothering you emotionally. Because I know I very much feared certain emotions, namely grief. Grief I ran from for 5 years. I had trouble dealing with my dad passing away and would constantly have dreams that he was still alive. Though in my dreams, he was still alive, but dying of cancer. And then I woke up to think, oh no, my dad is dying. And then would quickly recognize, wait, no, he's already dead. And then just all the symptoms of colon spasms and bleeding and pain. Leaning into those symptoms is actually so much easier than I ever realized, because being in crippling, disabling pain and non-pain symptoms is so much worse. So only when my physical symptoms went away could I do the deeper work of leaning in. Otherwise, for most people, I would just say it's very important to take a step back and recognize where the symptoms are coming from. For those who want to really be certain, they should really get diagnosed so that they can just move forward with accepting the diagnosis and not question it over and over. That questioning it is just anxiety just rolled up over and over in a loop.
Yeah, no, I can empathize with that. The grief thing is interesting. There's a couple of emotions that, because so much of Sarno's work was around rage, and this came up when I talked to Dr. Arlene Feinblatt a few weeks ago and Dr. Eric Sherman, is that they had said, like, the assumption is rage, meaning rage like anger, like you throw your chair across the room and you yell and all this kind of stuff. But one really subtle distinction that they made was that, you know, rage is almost like this, it's like a blanket term, basically, is kind of how it should be thought of. So it could be shame, it could be guilt, it could be grief. Like, there's just a variety of things that it could be. So always pointing at rage, the traditional term that we think of, which is, you know, unparalleled anger. It could be an unparalleled anger, but the root of that could be grief of a, you know, your father passing away. It could be feeling ashamed over something that you find incredibly embarrassing for you, like, and not just taking rage at surface value and leaving it at that.
Yeah, you know, I want to point out quickly that I definitely experienced all of those difficult emotions, and I recognized it later what each emotion caused in a symptom. I was experiencing rage because of the way that the dancer community shunned me and the frustration of all these doctor's appointments where I was told to just suck up and deal with being in chronic pain for the rest of my life. I was enraged for that, and that caused chest pain. I was grief-stricken over the loss of my dad of colon cancer, and that caused colon symptoms. I was dealing with shame from having been sexually assaulted so many times in my life that I was starting to feel like I had a sign on my forehead that said, go for it. And I didn't know why, and I was often told that I must be asking for it, so that caused shame that I had to deal with. And then guilt. I felt so much guilt for wanting to commit suicide and knowing how much that would destroy my mom. And, oh, that was a hard one.
I've heard it said before that, like in the realm of this work, that there could be a certain correlation between, like, what kind of a symptom you have and maybe what the root of it is. I had heard in some kind of an interview somebody talking about, it might have even been somebody that I had interviewed, but they were talking about sexual assault and the correlation to women that have pelvic pain. And I thought that was interesting. And then it got me thinking even further about Steve Ozanich. In one of his books, had talked about this idea that, like, yes, genetics exist, meaning if my dad has hip problem or if my dad has hip issues with on imaging, I'm likely to have hip issues on imaging. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be a production of pain or that our instances are going to be exactly the same. Meaning, like, genetics doesn't pass down anything really except for, you know, how you process emotional events and things like that. I think about when you say that your father passed away of colon cancer, you start to get very, very similar symptoms. And I feel like maybe there's really something to that, like in a ha-ha scenario or a ha-ha joking way. Like, my wife has had some back issues recently. So, of course, I went to Barnes & Noble. I got her two of Sarno's books, even though I do this stuff, right? And like,
you have 50 already.
Yeah, right. Well, I have them all in Kindle is the problem. So I've started to make it's a New Year's resolution to buy physical books. To stop.
I tend to buy both. I both listen and read. I'm cool. Visual and I multitask.
Yeah. So my wife's been, her back quote unquote goes out last weekend. She said some interesting things to me that correlated that I feel like have a lot of merit. But one thing that was interesting about that is my daughter, our 4.5-year-old, like, for the several days afterwards, she was like going to school and making cards for mom because mom's back hurts. And then like she started walking around the house bent, you know, hunched over saying that her back was hurting. And I'm like, four years old. You know what I mean? So like, these are the images like that kids see or that they think of. And I feel like it could work exactly the same way. If my, forbid, like something happens to one of my parents, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that whatever it is that they could pass away of, assuming it was an organic disease, I start feeling like I have those things. I think that that's totally, and like, you know, my mom has rheumatoid arthritis, and I remember starting to think like, maybe this is what I have in my spine. Like, this is what I'm destined for. And you know, I'm going to be in pain the rest of my life. And that's the catastrophizing again, like you talked about.
Right. Fearing it can actually cause you to have the symptoms of it. That's essentially the hypochondria element of it, even though, to clarify, your audience should know this by now if they've listened to your other podcasts, and my audience should know this by now if they watched my Got Pain Care videos. Mind-body doesn't mean that it's all in your head. It means it's generated by the brain, and it's real physical symptoms caused through learned neural pathways. And the pain and non-pain symptoms are often worse than their structurally caused counterparts, 100%.
Yeah, and that's one of Sarno's quotes is that this, tomato, tomato, PPD, TMS, like, but he has in all of his books a quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but that this syndrome is more painful than anything that he was aware of in medicine. I think is so, it's like exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. I actually think it's a perfect segue because you had talked about the videos. Like I said, like if you type in Dr. Sarno or you type in TMS, like your videos are very like top of the list on YouTube of ones that you will see. So how did you get into doing that work? And then I want to talk about what you're doing with PPDA.
Yeah, sure. Well, the fact that not only that I recovered, but the fact that I recovered so quickly, I feel like I recovered faster than even a over-the-counter pain pill could have helped me with. I was so blown away with how I did not already know this information, despite having a BFA in dance. I studied kinesiology, physical therapy, sports medicine, injury prevention, and multiple modalities. Everyone I know is a dancer or health professional. Even at that time, I was just surrounded by people who are obsessed with making sure they can dance for as long as humanly possible. It is our job to stay the best physical shape we can be. We have to bend back and half, forwards and backwards. And yet nobody had told me about this. Or if they did, they said it in a way that I just couldn't internalize at the time. I even had a dance teacher who I only remembered after the fact said, as I was actually headed to the ER for having intestinal bleeding, one of my first incidences of it, the summer of 2008, I said, oh my gosh, I have to get checked out. My dad had colon cancer and I can't wait to get checked out. I have to make sure that I'm okay. And she said, you know, stress can cause your body to do a lot of things. And I'm like, well, how can it be stress if I'm bleeding? So, I mean, ugh. Because I didn't know this information sooner, I wanted to make it my mission to help other people find this out before they go commit suicide or have a terrible experience or even have to quit dance or any kind of avoid any activity that gives them joy if they think, oh, I just have to live the rest of my life without ever doing X, Y, or Z. And right. It's fine. Just deal with it. I want to help all those people. So I used my background in dance, acting on camera, hosting on camera, and the film production work I had done up till that point, as well as marketing. I've worked in marketing for almost 9 years. I put together a web series that I just produced myself and edited myself, which I had to learn how to do, because I'm someone who loves going to YouTube to search for, you know, not just cat videos, but also other stuff too. So I wanted to make YouTube videos that just put this out there and directed viewers to the experts, the health professionals who wrote the books. I directed them to the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, which I had a hard time finding on the internet originally because, you know, they didn't have anyone with marketing experience by at the time that I found them in 2015. So yeah, I started with making Got Pain Cure, and I was so excited when people from around the world began writing me saying how this helped them on their recovery journey in one way or another. And that led me to collaborating with many of the mind-body professionals in this industry, including Dr. David Clark, who is amazing. And I was so glad that he became my scientific advisor for my web series to make sure that everything I said was completely accurate, but I also got to say it in my tone of voice. He would just review it. And yeah, that led to me now being the outreach director of the PPDA and doing what I do on a much larger scale.
Yeah. So, so Dr. David Clark, so he appeared in All the Rage, the Michael Galinsky, Dr. Sarno film, and he actually had one of the more, provocative is probably not the right word, but one of the things that he had said in there is when he was talking about, it was just after they were talking about the adverse childhood experience study, and he was saying that basically everything that could happen to you if you score high on this, meaning 20 times more likely to have emphysema, 20 times more likely to die 20 years younger, that kind of stuff. But and I think that maybe when people think about that stuff, they just say, I'm doomed, right? So we get back into catastrophizing and all that. But he had said, fortunately, you can reverse this. And that's when, and I'm like, what a statement from a physician who I feel like so many doctors, and it's not, you know, again, like, I have a lot of empathy for doctors who have been blamed by people that are in the TMS world saying like, all you care about is money because like, again, it's very expensive and it's a lot of work to become a doctor. But there is a certain phrase sometimes that you won't ever be able to do this again, right? Whatever that thing is, dance, weightlifting, right. Whatever it is. I was told like, you know, you're never going to be able to squat again, you know, give that up. And I'm like, okay, like maybe it's not life or death, right? But however, I'm like, weightlifting is my sport. Like, I love doing this, and I'm 29 when you're telling me this. Like, get out of it. Like, right. Like, you know, right. It is sort of the end of the world, right, to somebody who that's one of their biggest hobbies. So Dr. Clark's he's awesome because he made that statement. I'm sure awesome in a lot of other ways. But as the outreach director, like, tell us what you do. Like, what is your mission? What's the mission of the organization?
Yeah, well, so the PPDA is the only 501c3 health education nonprofit doing the work that we do at all. There's actually no other nonprofit like us. So our work involves advancing the diagnosis and treatment of stress-induced medical conditions, which is a long list, everything from chronic pain, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and non-pain symptoms like irritable bowel syndrome, and much more. And I've had a lot of those. And a lot of our focus is around education, which is actually a key component in the treatment process. And that's why our work to educate health professionals and patients about psychophysiologic disorders, which goes by many names, but that's the clinical term in the clinical research being done. This is a vital step toward actually ending the chronic pain epidemic and opioid crisis. So that's our mission.
Yeah, that is. And what's like, tell me about some of the names that are, we talked about this off air, but tell me about some of the other names that are involved.
Yeah, well, so Dr. David Clark is the president and one of the co-founders. And our co-founders include He goes by Forrest Smith. He's the creator of the TMS Wiki, so a lot of people on who listen to your show would know Forrest Smith. Dr. Howard Schubiner, who is super prominent in this work, author of Unlearn Your Pain and Unlearn Your Anxiety and Depression, also one of the co-investigators for the current randomized controlled trial about psychophysiologic disorders, which is so exciting when that gets published. Another co-investigator who's on our board is Alan Gordon, LCSW.
And this is what's going on in Boulder, right, that you're referencing?
Correct. Okay. Yep. The one that Christy is also involved with. Yep. And Alan Gordon, who's one of our board members, is the executive director of the Pain Psychology Center, where Christy also is there. And then we also have Dr. Alicia Batson, who's a psychiatrist, and Dr. David Schechter, both of whom you've interviewed. And you also interviewed Dr. David Hanscom, which just became a board member as of yesterday.
That's awesome. It's nice to have some Pacific Northwest presence in that group, because the closest person to, that I'm looking at, I guess Alan Gordon, David Schechter, they're both in my, sort of my, they're on the West Coast. And then David Clark is out of Oregon, and then Hanscom's 20 miles from me. So that's cool.
Yeah. And currently I'm the lonely one in New York City, but previously had board members, both Dr. Eric Sherman, who you interviewed, and Dr. Frances Summer Anderson, were previous board members who are out of New York City. And we're connected with about around 151 practitioners in the world. And our aim is to continue adding trained professionals to that list, so that anyone who visits our website, ppdassociation.org, can find a health professional, either a medical doctor, a mental health professional, or a health coach, or chiropractor, physical therapist. Jim Prusik, who you also interviewed, is on that list. And we also have a lot of resources. So even for visitors who've already been diagnosed, or they've already had therapy, or maybe they can't afford therapy, there's plenty of resources that you can do, either free or the price of a book or the price of the Curable app. Lots of options. I mean, I made my full recovery from buying an $8 book on Amazon. So
yeah, and that certainly speaks to, like, you know, it's each to their own, or whatever that phrase that everybody uses is. One of the things that I'm thinking of, so I feel like I see a lot of people asking, like, you know, there's no doctor in my area, there's no psychologist in my area, and I'm looking at the directory now, and it's pretty extensive. How do you go about finding additional practitioners? Is it something where, like, there's probably let's say there's 100 on this list. I don't know whether there is or there is not.
Is
151. 151. Okay, good guess.
Precise.
Is it one of those things where there's probably a lot more practitioners out there that practice in this way, but it's just a matter of finding them and figuring out who they are?
Oh, definitely. Either we haven't connected with them yet, or they might have a very different approach. So there was a certain amount of vetting that goes through who is on our list. A lot of that came through what Forrest Smith did for the TMS Wiki. I compiled that list and the old PPDA's list, because we have a new website. So currently we have the most comprehensive list of not just mind-body professionals, because that's a very broad term, but professionals who can diagnose and or treat this condition in the most effective evidence-based ways. And on our directory, which if you go to, you know, just ppdassociation.org/directory, there's a quick search tool. You can click on remote practitioners who can treat over video and telephone. A lot of them can Skype, including those at the Pain Psychology Center, which Alan runs, and also SERPA.org, which Georgie Oldfield runs. And while Georgie's not directly with us, we view SERPA as like our sister organization.
I just got a DM from Georgie. We're going to eventually get the time zones figured out. And because it's one thing for, like, she's in the UK and you're in New York. So if you two were talking, I'm all the way I'm in like Alaska pretty much. And so to get it all the way over here, but she will be on eventually. She actually sends, she said that there's a ton of people that come into her clinic that had heard about this stuff from my show, which I think is so, like, that just shows, like, the power of media and this kind of stuff. Like, you're in New York, I found this book on Amazon, and then somehow got me to your videos, and then we got connected, and now we're on the phone, right? So, like, it's the network certainly seems like it's growing. I know that Nicole Sachs, one thing that she had said to me a couple of years ago was that she feels like, you know, maybe it might only be something like 10 years away before there's a massive shift in the way that this stuff is treated and looked at.
Yep. Yep. Dr. Clark also feels like it's a 10-year. I would love if I can help accelerate that. And we have very clear ideas on how we're going to go about that.
Yep. Definitely.
Yeah. Mainly targeting health insurers. Not only do they have the financial vested interest to reduce their medical loss ratio, which is the term that basically implies that they spend a lot of money on healthcare treatments that currently are not effective, like low back surgery and steroid injections, physical therapy, et cetera. And instead, if they invested in the biopsychosocial approach that we have developed, then that would save them a lot of money. So we hope to work with them because this is only going to be a benefit to health insurers and patients as well. And then the key is just educating the professionals, all the current professionals and all the students who are going through med school, as well as the public. And so much of that is online because A, we are a small nonprofit in the sense that we can't be everywhere all at once. And this work is global in scale, but also it's a great way to reach people with free materials and affordable materials. You just saw the release of the preview of our online continued medical education course that I co-created with Dr. Clark. And we have that course coming out, so that'll reach a lot of people. So hopefully the next time I go to certain hospitals in New York that I went to in 2013, they will tell me about PPD,
yeah.
And that would be amazing. Yeah. So I'm working with the many hospitals that I actually went to, and I would love to see how they react to this information.
Yeah, that actually gives me a good idea. I'm scrolling through this directory and I'm like, gosh, it's like a wish list of people. And I think I'm going to Chicago in a few weeks, and it would be awesome to somehow get connected with Dr. Strax and do an in person. That would be pretty awesome. So
I love how our directory is a shopping list for your guests.
Yeah. Gosh, no kidding.
I'm glad we could work that out for you. I taught myself web development just to help you find your podcast guests.
Someone had once told me that, I mean, basically the inverse of that, but that the podcast list of episodes became a shopping list for them on practitioners to go and read about. So.
Oh, sure. It goes all ways. I mean, people have to find out about this in order to have their options. That's why also the benefit to the PPDA being a nonprofit is that we're an umbrella organization, and our only mission is to actually solve this healthcare problem until it's not a problem anymore. So we're not for-profit focused. Therefore, we direct people to all the best resources that are, you know, both financially easier for them and effective treatment. So that's our goal. We're not just trying to direct people to us. We don't treat patients at the PPDA. We do the clinical research. We funded that Boulder study. That is something that we fundraised, and our board members are the ones are part of the inspectors for that. So yeah, we're doing a lot of amazing work that people have already heard of. They just couldn't pronounce Psychophysiologic Disorders Association until now. So now they know who we are, but we've been around doing this for 9 years.
That's awesome. Jessica, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to link all the stuff that she had talked about, the website, the video series, all that stuff will be in the show notes that you can find either on iTunes or Spotify or wherever it is that you listen to this. It'll just be in the info section. So thank you again, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.